everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 28th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. You know, I say it every week and I'll say it again. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And the only reason that we can stay afloat is because of the support from listeners just like you. If you want to show your support for the show, there's a lot of ways you can do it. And only just a couple of them cost money, like going to patreon.com and pledging on a per episode basis. I want to give a shout out to the top patrons this week, including Rob Schreck, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe, Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so very much. But you know, there's a bunch of other ways that you can also support. You can visit the TalkNerdyMerch.com website to shop for some cool Talk Nerdy swag. You can rate or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, anywhere that you get your podcast. And lastly, you can just tell your friends and family about the show. That's honestly the most important thing that you can do, is get the word out. Thanks in advance. All right, guys, this week it is a really fascinating episode. I interview the author of You, A Natural History, Dr. William B. Irvine. Now, Dr. Irvine is a philosopher, and this book is a really cool book because it takes multiple perspectives in telling the story of us, you know, kind of the physics perspective, the chemistry perspective, the biology perspective, the social perspective. You know, you're a member of a species, you're a collection of cells, you're a collection of atoms, but always with a really interesting philosophical bent. And we dig super deep into the Stoic position, something that I really didn't know anything about before, and it's really enlightening. I had a great time interviewing Dr. Irvine. I think you'll have a great time listening. So without any further ado, here he is, Dr. William B. Irvine. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
I am really excited to talk all about your new book, You, A Natural History, but also about all of your incredible work as a philosophy professor, because I don't know if we've actually had a single philosophy professor on the show. At the very least, we haven't had too many. The show is very science heavy. And of course, this book is also very science heavy. But I think that the philosophy of natural science is such an important field. It's such an important, I guess, perspective to approach science from. And I'm just not sure we do it enough in the sciences.
Well, this is a science with a philosophical viewpoint, but for ordinary people. So I'm not writing for specialists. I'm not writing for scientists. I'm writing for people who have just had some very basic questions, because I found that I had some very basic questions that it seemed like the sources I was reading always assumed that the answer had been worked out. Now, we don't need to think about that anymore, and let's go on from there. But, you know, when you start talking about species, for instance, it becomes quite an interesting conversation you can have. And so I started thinking more carefully about the things in science I had taken for granted, and this book is the end result of that thought process.
Well, and it's so perfect for those of us. I think most of the people who listen to Talk Nerdy are really in a similar boat. I've done a couple of what do you call them? Like polls or surveys of my listenership. And for people who tend to respond to those, of course, it's a small sample and there's some selection bias there. It does appear to be that, a small portion or maybe a decent portion of the listeners are in academia, are working on either their undergraduate degrees or their graduate degrees. But the vast majority of the listeners are, I guess, what I like to call science enthusiasts, people who maybe never formally studied science, but are super interested in it. We'll flip to a cool science doc on television, or might pick up, if they're looking at a magazine about to board a flight, they might pick up a Discover or a National Geographic. So I think that this book is just perfect for the people listening to this podcast right now.
Well, science is great stuff. It's interesting stuff. It's exciting stuff. And I want to make the claim that you have within you multiple very interesting stories. You have your atoms. Each has its own stories. Your cells have stories. Your species has a story. And they're great stories, and they need to be told. And so I wrote the book, You, trying to tell that story to the best extent that I could.
I love that. So really what this is a kind of multidisciplinary approach to the story of me, to the story of you. How does a, you know, geneticist think or perceive what it means to be human and how we got to where we are today? How does an evolutionary biologist, how does a psychologist, how does a physicist? Because of course, all of these different fields of science are valid. All of these different fields of science have very strong theories with multiple converging lines of evidence to support them. Yet they're all a slightly different pair of glasses, aren't they?
Yeah, and to get the full picture, you need to, at some level, wear all of the pairs of glasses. If you talk to a biologist, you know, what you are is a member of a species. If you talk to a physicist, no, you're a collection of cells. If you talk to a geneticist, they'll tell you, well, they'll break the news to you that your genes are really in charge. Your genes, some of them have been around for billions of years, and you are simply the machine with which they replicate themselves. No more, no less, you know, and it kind of puts you into a different frame. And then we can have the question of, well, who's right? Is it the physicist? Is it the biologist? Is it the geneticist? Is it the cell biologist? And the answer is, well, they're all right. It's a big picture, and it's a multifaceted picture. And if you want to really appreciate the picture, you have to look at all of the facets. Now, the problem is, any of those facets, you can go really, really deep. Mm-hmm. And so what I tried to do, I was kind of like a diver. I would go into these different areas, go deep, and then surface and simply report, okay, so here's what's lurking there. And so trying to bring things to a level where there's this kind of narrative that runs through the whole story. And at the same time, you know, don't overdose on science. It's anything I touch on can be delved in more deeply, but I was very careful to place limits on how deep I went.
And I think that that's much appreciated, especially when you look at the book. It's a manageable length, if that makes sense. For some people, you know, a lifetime of work. For example, it's been a big year this past year for stories about evolutionary biology. Two books come to mind, two individuals that I interviewed on the show. David Quammen wrote The Tangled Tree, and Carl Zimmer wrote She Has Your Mother's Laugh, and or She Has Her Mother's Laugh. And especially Carl Zimmer's book, I mean, it's such an important contribution to the field. It's such an important example of popular kind of narrative nonfiction science writing. But it's also a tome. It's an investment. Whereas I do think that your book is something that doesn't scare people away, maybe I should say, from reading it. It really is good bedtime reading. And you could probably get through it, depending on your speed. I'm a very slow reader, but maybe in a week or two, which is not too overwhelming for most people.
Yeah, to the extent possible, I'm trying to tell stories, and there the story's always with a scientific spin. But you know, look at the world from the point of view of say one of your nitrogen atoms. You have a bunch of atoms, some of them are nitrogen atoms, and from their point of view, you're just a way station in a very long journey that began billions of years ago. If you're a nitrogen atom, not only did it begin long ago, but it began in the core of a star that subsequently exploded. That's where your atoms, nitrogen atoms, were formed. And then the interesting question is, what happened to get them to you. And, you know, you start telling that story. Well, you know, they entered you in the food that you ate. Say you had a steak that had lots of protein, that had nitrogen atoms. Well, where did the cow that steak come from get those nitrogen atoms? Well, from grass. And you can actually trace back history. Now, it becomes highly speculative, you know, before you get very far back. But you know, you're going to end up somehow in the core of a star that exploded. And the other thing to think about is if you're worried about your afterlife, your atoms will outlast you by far. And they'll go on after you're gone. They'll go on to have new adventures of their own. They probably were parts of living things before, and the foods you ate, and they probably will be again. So you have this kind of atomic immortality. You know, you can also think of the cellular you, because you are a collection of cells. Those cells link back cell by cell by cell. If they did their complete family tree, they would get back to the first living organism on the planet Earth, the very first living thing, which would have been a cellular organism. They can trace their ancestry back to that organism. And along the way, the cell has simply divided. From its point of view, what does it do? It grows and divides. It grows and divides. It grows and divides. And after several billion years, it's maybe the fertilized cell, the ovum and sperm that combined to make the cell that ultimately went on to make you. And that cell can have an afterlife. If you had kids, the kids, their cells can trace their family tree, their cellular family tree, back to you. So it becomes a much bigger picture where we have, we can look at you in different respects, and we can tell some wonderful stories about each of those respects in which you can be said to exist.
It really is, in many ways, a collection of stories about, I don't know, conservation, about this connective thread that continued long before we were born, long before our own individual, I guess, consciousness arose, and will continue long after we're dead, long after, you know, kind of the lights go out and we're no longer conscious. And it's such a beautiful realization, I think, for a lot of people, whether they're religious or secular, like myself. You know, for many people, I think, who don't find comfort in religion, this conversation about the, I guess, ongoing nature of reality, this thread that's in many ways unbroken, was unbroken to create you. It's hard to not see the profundity in that. It's hard to not look at it with a real sense of awe and a real sense of being, I don't know, connected to something much, much larger. Not necessarily God, unless you're the person who believes in that. But even for those of us who don't believe, there's still something bigger out there, which is this unbroken thread.
Yeah, I would officially classify myself as an agnostic, but in the book I have I do explore things from a creationist point of view, because it's interesting and it kind of puts things into perspective. So I just now we're talking, and I said there was a cell that you can trace, that all currently living cells can trace their origin back to. But if you're a creationist, that isn't true. There were separate moments of creation, you know, one for oak trees, one for human beings. So they end up not with a tree of life with one root, but with a forest of life, right, for each of the different things that came into existence. And of course, they would say that if anybody did their family tree, they would trace it back to Adam and Eve, ultimately. Yeah. Whereas we, who don't take that point of view, wouldn't do that.
But we might trace it back to, you know, what many people might call a mitochondrial Eve, for example. So it is interesting that even though those terms were borrowed from the religious, and even though there is no, you know, belief there within most of the natural sciences of like an actual Eden and an actual creation myth, that there is still a beginning somewhere.
Yep.
There had to be.
And that person is described as the most recent common ancestor. And the interesting thing is, you know, when you refer to it as the mitochondrial Eve, mm-hmm. or whatever, it's tempting to think that this was somehow a special and very important person. But in the book, I describe how there's a chance that you yourself could become the most recent common ancestor of every living person on Earth. And if you did so, it would be by luck. Go to a deserted island far away with a member of the opposite sex and be lucky enough to be there when the rest of mankind is wiped out, and then start making kids. And then you will thereby become the most recent ancestor of what will ultimately be humankind. They will all point back to you. Yeah, so the person who holds that spot just got lucky. And you know what? If something had happened to them, there's a very good chance that someone else would have taken on that role.
Yeah. And when we look back at all of human history, and we're talking about, you know, Homo sapiens, the 200 or some odd thousand years of our existence, it's not that it's just been a smooth and steady population explosion. In very recent years, yes, it has. Like, there haven't been nearly as many bottlenecks. But historically, of course, there were events that required that caused the population to boom and bust. Of course, there were events, massive dieout events, diseases, epidemics, things of that nature, where we saw evolution in action. We saw a resilient few being able to repopulate certain areas. And I think we often like to think of, our lineage as being just that, a lineage, and as being something that's been a slow and steady growth, but it's really not that clean, is it?
No, we are very, very lucky. And, you know, we're like the person who won the lottery. And so the person who won the lottery can think of all sorts of reasons why they were especially deserving, and how it was somehow ordained. And the rest of us look at that person and say, no, that's just the lucky fool who won the lottery. And we're the lucky fools who won the lottery of life. We're still here. Mm-hmm. And through a number of processes, we, very interesting processes, actually, we have this ability to think and to communicate and to do a variety of things that make us pretty unique among animals on Earth. Now, I'm convinced there is life elsewhere in the universe, and very highly likely, almost certain, there's intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. So we aren't a one-off kind of deal. We got lucky, and there are other places where things have gotten lucky as well.
Absolutely. And of course, I mean, I think in a minute, I want to really come back to all of those different perspectives and why you chose to write the book in that way, because I do think it's a really unique way to approach this conversation. But I want to take a couple steps back first and talk about you and your career and sort of some of the things that I think probably led to this book. You are not a practicing scientist, although I did introduce you at the beginning as Dr. William Irvine, because you are a professor of philosophy. You are just really interested in the sciences. I want to get to the philosophy and the different perspectives within philosophy in just a moment. But first, I want to know, what made you so interested in telling science stories and in dedicating some of your time to the scientific point of view?
I've had a lifelong interest in science. And when I went off to college, I had sort of a background interest in philosophy. I had just as a senior in high school, I had discovered Bertrand Russell, and I had discovered Henry David Thoreau, and thought, well, this is some very interesting stuff. I wonder what anybody does with it. But I went off to college intending to be a physics major, and I started out taking physics courses and did quite well. But then it occurred to me that physics is really, really hard, and as most people can imagine. And my interest in philosophy was growing stronger all that time. So I ended up being a kind of a sensible individual. I knew that a philosophy major was a very risky thing because finding employment subsequently, you know, teaching philosophy is difficult to do. And if you don't teach philosophy, then you can't really be employed as a philosopher. You can go to law school or something like that, but I wasn't interested. But by that time, I had taken enough math courses in conjunction with my physics that I started out in that I figured out what I would do is get a double major in math and physics. And then if I couldn't find employment, double major in math and philosophy, then if I couldn't find employment in philosophy, I would just bill myself as a math major and kind of hide the philosophy aspect. Because, you know, an employer would say, oh, math, that's useful, you know, but philosophy, they tend to be skeptical. But then I got very lucky and was able to find lifelong employment in philosophy. That gives me license to think about any number of things. And so what I do with respect to books is I just discover that I'm collecting material in something. It's sort of like this, if you're a woman, discovering that you're pregnant, you know, discovering that I'm heavy with book. And it's just a question of what captures my attention. And in this case, I said I've had a lifelong interest in science. And, you know, I started thinking about myself and my different selves and their different histories. And then it dawned on me, there's a book there. Long, slow book to write because it was a background project while I was working on other books. But deeply rewarding in the sense of having arrived at a sense of understanding of kind of a bigger picture, not the bigger picture. I don't know if anybody can understand that perfectly, but just a better understanding of how I came to be here and a better understanding of what it means.
And of course, this is not your only book. Like you mentioned, you've written several books, many of them about kind of the human experience, about insight, about relationships, interaction. But also you wrote a book all about Stoicism, about the, you know, the perspective of the of Stoic philosophy. I would love to take maybe a few minutes to dive into that, because I'll say, you know, we were talking offline before we started recording. You had read up on me and mentioned that you noticed that I was a philosophy minor in just my undergrad way back when. And that is true. I then went on to neuroscience. And now I'm in clinical psych, and I've gone back to a philosophical point of view because I'm a humanistic existentially oriented student of clinical psychology. But in my undergrad, my philosophy training was very heavy. I think it was just the way my university was oriented on political philosophy and I would say like ethical, moral, religious philosophy. So that's really what I got. You know, my intro to philosophy course was Plato and Machiavelli. Like, I didn't really get to learn much about history and systems in philosophy and learn about all the different viewpoints. You know, I don't know much about the difference between epistemology and phenomenology and all these different views. And the Stoics, I know very little about. So I would love, and I'm not sure that most people listening are like, well, what the hell is Stoic philosophy? So I'd love a little maybe background on that.
Oftentimes when I write a book, I have two programs going on. One is it's a publication, you know, and I'm a philosopher, and this is one of the things they pay me to do. But secondly, it's a chance to explore very deeply something that I'm interested in. And isn't that a wonderful life that somebody is going to pay you to say, well, what are you interested in? Can you look into it? And as a philosopher, I have that freedom to an extraordinary extent. So back in 2004, I had an interest in becoming a Zen Buddhist. And I decided that, and as a background project, what I would do is write a book that was connected with that. And then it's kind of like you get a twofer the price of one. You get a book out of it, and then you get to explore something that you have a personal interest in. So the idea was become a Zen Buddhist. And to do that, I needed to think more about desire and the way desire functions in human beings. So I wrote a book titled On Desire, and Oxford University Press was happy to publish it, and it did pretty well. And in order to completely cover desire, I had to look at different approaches people had taken to dealing with human desire. And of course, there were the Zen Buddhists, but along the way, just to be complete, I had to talk about the Stoics, because they had their own theory regarding human desire. And then, surprise, surprise, I came out of the book realizing that I just really wasn't cut out to be a Zen Buddhist, but that Stoicism worked really fine. You know, it's the kind of thing that you can experiment with for one weekend, and then you will know one way or another whether it's working for you. And working means providing you with a tranquil existence. And that's a word that can be misunderstood many different ways. So, it has to be explored further. But then I decided that my next book after that would be a book on Stoicism. I assumed that given that it kind of followed on the coattails of the Desire book, there's a good chance Oxford would publish it, and they did. But I also assumed that very few people would be interested in learning about Stoicism. And it turns out I was massively wrong on that respect, because the book has been out for 10 years now and has sold quite well and continues to sell quite well. And in the meantime, there has been this global upwelling of interest in Stoic philosophy. So I was lucky enough to get in the right place at the right time. So that, and I would call myself today, if you said, what am I? Well, I'm a Stoic. And then if you're interested, we can explore what that entails.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know if, obviously, I've heard of the Stoics, and I think of it as a more like kind of ancient philosophical viewpoint. But of course, I'm sure that there's a modern twist that you take to it. But I'm not sure I fully grasp what it is to be a Stoic and how it is maybe different than, I don't know, some other, like, you know, the viewpoint that I'm most familiar with, which would be the existential philosophers.
Okay. Stoicism is about having a good life. And then the question is, so what does that mean? Because it can mean different things to different people. To many of my contemporary Americans, having a good life means owning lots of great stuff and being able to spend lots of money. And the philosophers who have explored that point of view have unanimously agreed, no, that's a recipe for a truly miserable existence. So they had to come up with other ways of understanding what was worth having in life. And among the Stoics, now, this is all debatable, and if you get Stoics together, they will start arguing about this. But there's the Greek Stoics came first, and then were followed by the Roman Stoics, people like Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Musonius Rufus. And the Roman Stoics are what I would identify with most, and their thought was, if you want to identify what a successful life is, it's a life that's filled with tranquility. And let me explain that. Tranquility for them doesn't mean this zombie-like state where you're just kind of zoned out. For them, tranquility means a life with as few negative emotions as possible. So they're against they want to get rid of grief. They want to get rid of regret. They want to get rid of anger. So you can go through the list of emotions. But that doesn't mean they were anti-emotion. So they had nothing wrong with emotions like delight, like joy even. Now, they weren't out for euphoria, because that's not a long-lasting thing and has certain consequences. But they thought that your goal in life should be to try to maximize tranquility, have as few negative emotions as possible, but take delight in these positive emotions. And the interesting thing is, they thought they had a way to arrive at that psychological state. By the way, the Zen Buddhists did as well, but they had a different way of getting to that state. So it's an interesting thing. They shared the goal, but had a different way of getting to the goal. And for the Stoics, they have some basic techniques that they use. And also I'll quickly describe one of them here. It's called negative visualization. So as an activity, you don't do this nonstop, but every now and then in life, you just take a few moments to think about what it would be like not to have something that you have. And it has an incredibly powerful psychological impact, because you do that and you realize what a lucky human being you are. Even if you think you have been deprived of almost everything, still you've got so many things that if you lost them, would have a true, a major, a catastrophic impact on you. And so most people who are dissatisfied with life, they spend their days thinking about what it is they don't have that they wish they did have. And Stoics would say that's backward. What you need to think about is the things you do have, and think about what life would be like without those things.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick break to thank a new sponsor of this week's episode, Warby Parker. I love Warby Parker. I don't know if you guys know what I look like because you listen to my voice all the time, but I wear glasses every single day. And with Warby Parker, it's really easy to accessorize with glasses because they're incredibly affordable. And you don't even have to go to the store unless you want to. Some cities have Warby Parker stores, but you can do this really great thing called a home try-on. It's 100% free. You order 5 pairs of glasses. They send them to you so you can try them on for 5 days. They don't have your lenses in them yet. And you can look in the mirror. You can ask your friends, you know, what they think. There's no obligation to buy. It ships for free and it includes a prepaid return shipping label. It's awesome. As soon as you decide which pair you want, you can send them back and then they'll give you a brand new custom pair with your lenses, you know, with your perfect prescription. So great. I just did it and I'm really excited about my new Finch rose crystal glasses. They're so cute. I can't wait for you guys to try. Also, do you know where the name Warby Parker comes from? I just learned this from a Jack Kerouac journal. Apparently, two of his earliest characters were named Zag Parker and Warby Pepper. And so they said, you know, Kerouac inspired a generation to take a road less traveled, as we all know, but also to see the world through a different lens. Get it? I get it. All right, guys, their glasses start at $95. They include prescription lenses and they're anti-glare and anti-scratch. And get this, for every pair you buy, a pair is distributed to someone in need. I love that. Also, check out Warby Parker's iTunes app. It makes it super, super easy to continue, you know, with the whole process, the home try-on, shopping for all these incredible pairs of glasses that are, again, super affordable. If you've got an iPhone X, make sure to download Warby Parker's app. You can actually find your fit by, like, kind of trying on the glasses using the iPhone X's True Depth camera. It's super cool. So guys, what are you waiting for? You can start your free home try-on right now by going to warbyparker.com/nerdy. Again, that's warbyparker.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Zola for partnering with Talk Nerdy this week. Zola is the wedding company that will do anything for love, and they're actually reinventing the wedding planning and registry experience to make it happy and easy and, you know, stress-free like a wedding actually should be. You can join the other over 500,000 couples who have used Zola already because it's by far the easiest way to plan your wedding and your registry. A, you get a free wedding website, you get your dream wedding registry, and also affordable save the dates and invitations and super easy to use planning tools all in one place and all online. Like I said, your wedding website is absolutely free. It's super easy. It only takes minutes to set up because you can choose from 100 really gorgeous designs and they'll fit, you know, anybody's style. You can personalize it, add photos, add FAQs, and then you can put your registry directly on your wedding site so that like everybody knows all the details that they need. They can get your wedding gift in one convenient and beautiful place. The registry is awesome, you guys. Your guests will get free shipping and returns, price matching, and a lot more. And there's over 500 top brands from OXO and Cuisinart all the way to Sonos and Airbnb. And you can register for gift cards. That's super important. And also, they have the best completion discount out there, 20% off your remaining gifts starting right after your big day. So guys, what are you waiting for? To start your free wedding website and also get $50 off your registry on Zola, just go to zola.com/nerdy. Again, that's a free wedding website and $50 off your registry at zola.com/nerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. I think in some ways, I mean, obviously that's not the same. It's a different, like you said, approach to arriving at something of a similar outcome, because I think for most people, peace, joy, love, tranquility, these are goals in life. But when I look at a more kind of existential humanistic view, and of course this is a psychological view that's informed by many philosophers, there's kind of this idea of, I don't know what you would call it, maybe paradoxes, where in order to really understand love, you would have to have experienced loss, or in order to really feel alive and appreciate what we have in life, we have to explore the fact that we are mortal and that we're going to die, because without that one extreme, the other extreme just doesn't resonate the same way. And in that way, I do see like maybe a little bit of a parallel there.
Well, that there's actually experiencing something, but what's, and once you experience a loss, then you'll know, wow, you know, I really had something and now it's gone. Mm-hmm. But the psychological insight of the Stoics was, well, but there's something short of actually losing it. Just imagine that you've lost it. And again, I encourage listeners to give it a try in their own life, because I know that, in my life, and certainly in many of the people since this book came out, many people have written to me to ask questions and share their own experience. But for a whole bunch of people, it works wonderfully. And you know, you talk about experiencing love. There are a whole bunch of people who experience love and throw it away. And it's just the old story again, that once you have something, then that becomes your new base, you know, that's your point of comparison. And then the question is, well, okay, so now I've got this. So what's better than this? Whereas, you know, I mean, I've often thought this, if you are part of a loving human relationship, you're the recipient of a human miracle, or as close as it comes on Earth, that this sort of relationship would could exist between human beings is absolutely wonderful, breathtakingly wonderful. And if you think about it in those terms, it's much easier to keep such a relationship going. And it's an interesting thing, though, because just speaking of love, it seems like love is a dying emotion. I'm not quite sure why, but I talked to my students, and there was a time when if you were in college, you would have experienced love. And now it's true, it would seem, now I don't know if this is a scientific survey, but only about half of the students claim to have experienced love. And it's an interesting thing. And that makes me sad, but there you go.
Oh, it makes me sad too. I mean, you know, one thing that really strikes me as we're sitting here talking, and you're kind of describing both what the ancient Stoics and a much more modern kind of Stoic perspective, entail, is that it's so hopeful. Like, it's, I think a lot of people have an idea in their head, because most people, if you were to ask them, like, how many philosophers do you know? They'd be like, I know some armchair philosophers, but they might not know anybody who's like a quote unquote professional philosopher. And if you were to ask them, maybe when you think of a philosopher, what do you think of? The same way we do this all the time in the sciences. When you think of a scientist, what do you think of? And it's so sad because it's like an old white dude with a beard and a lab coat and crazy hair. And we're like, no, and really trying to kind of adjust those ideas. But I think if you were to ask people, when you think of a philosopher, what do you think of? They would be like somebody who's super depressed.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the other thing is about academic philosophers, those who do Stoicism, I mean, I'm very, very interested in sort of showing a modern audience that, hey, this stuff they were talking about 2,000 years ago is still utterly relevant and can be useful to you. I certainly have colleagues whose interest in Stoicism is simply to argue, you know, these debates that have been going on for 2,000 years. How come? Because you get a publication, right? And that this is how your career goes forward. And then you can say, but do you practice Stoicism? And they give you kind of a funny look as if, why would somebody do that?
What you're doing. They're like, I read about it.
You think about it, and that's how you that's how you make your living. Here's another thing to think about, though, in terms of the Stoics. Back when the Stoics, the Roman Stoics, walked the earth 2,000 years ago, you weren't just a philosopher. You wore many caps. So one of the things you were interested in was science. One of the things you were interested in was human psychology. You were interested in natural science. Mm-hmm. You were expected to be a kind of a generalist. So these Stoic philosophers, yes, they did philosophy, but they were also acutely interested in human psychology. And they studied the people around them and came up with these conclusions about, hey, here's techniques worth trying because they can make a real difference in your life. There's a potentially huge upside with almost no downside. You know, I said before about my thought about becoming a Zen Buddhist, you know, and then you kind of look into what that evolves. Okay, so I should probably head off to a monastery and should probably give it at least a decade, and maybe something will come out of it, and maybe something won't. And that's true. And there are people for whom it works, and it's a life-changing thing. But the interesting thing about Stoicism and the Stoic psychology that's used is I give it a weekend, and you'll know one way or another, and you don't have to shave off your hair or everything else to do it. So it's beautiful in that sense, very approachable, very low cost of entry, and yet can be life-changing. And, you know, I get emails from people, and apparently it can really touch a person's core in an interesting way.
I love that. And so, of course, reading that previous book that you wrote and just doing probably some quick Google searches, individuals can start to inform themselves and learn a little bit more about this Stoic viewpoint. It's interesting because, you know, there's so many like quote unquote self-help books out there. I don't know why I said quote unquote. They're legit, like just self-help books. There's so many what I think of as a scientific skeptic, kind of scammy approaches, kind of charlatan, snake oil salesman out there trying to sell people the good life and make a buck off of their back, trying to kind of, profit off of modern misery. And yet you're saying that there's this interesting Stoic philosophy that's been around for thousands of years. And I don't think most people have heard of it.
Most people haven't, and the sad thing is if they have heard of it, they have the absolute wrong idea. Mm-hmm. You know, the Stoic just sits there and silently suffers that's the point of Stoicism. So the book is Guide to the Good Life, and it's about the joy of being of Stoicism. And that sounds like a contradiction. What do you mean joyful Stoic? Well, that was the point, that you should live a life full of joy. And then the question is how to accomplish that. So it's an unfortunate name because, you know, I'm talking about the capital S Stoics, a philosophical group, and it's also a lowercase s kind of word in the dictionary, and you look it up, and it's grim, all suffering, and isn't that unfortunate?
Yeah, I think when I think of the word, what comes to mind is like poker face. Like that's what the word defines for me, is just not showing any emotion, which is in many ways not what it means to live a good life.
Yeah, and you read about some of the ancient Stoics, and they were people who seemed to perpetually have a smile on their face. So in that sense, just the opposite. I mean, if you wake up in the morning and you say, "Isn't this great? I get another chance to get things right." It just puts a different feel on the entire experience you're going to have that day than if you wake up thinking, "Oh, woe is me. What a miserable existence. I don't have what I want, and I'm never going to get what I want." So it's an approach to life.
Absolutely. And that, you know, that other approach, the alternative, which is so common and so, I'd say, insidious today, really is... Well, it is just that. It's insidious. It's just, I see it left and right, this idea of like the haves and the have-nots and keeping up with the Joneses. And I mean, there's so many American expressions to describe it simply because it's probably a completely natural outcome of the capitalist society that, you know, America has grown out of and of the sort of tribalistic, viewpoints that have developed over a lifetime, not just of American society, but a lifetime of kind of human interaction. But it's just so sad that that is really what defines so many people's lives. And it's really cool to know that there are these fundamental philosophical viewpoints, not these get rich quick schemes, not these self-help ideas, but these very basic literary and introspective sort of offerings out there that have been around for thousands of years that we can approach and internalize and use what we want and discard what we don't like. And it's, you know, it's smart for free. It's smart for the cost of a library card, which I think is also something that we often forget in modern society.
Yeah, and you know, so in conjunction with the Desire book, I looked into evolutionary psychology, which is absolutely fascinating, and there's a good chance that we're actually programmed to be restless, to be always seeking something better. Mm-hmm. If you were around on the savannas of Africa and you were easy to please, you know, and you said, "Well, I've got one coconut." I don't think they had coconuts on the savannas of Africa. You know, I think, and that does it for me today. I'm done. That person probably perished, whereas somebody who took a much more kind of acquisitive approach. Well, you know, I've got food, but more food is always a good thing.
And vigilance, you know, that was the name of the game back then. Don't get eaten.
Yeah. And then we've inherited that. And then, so some people would say, so it's natural to do. Well, actually, we don't live on the savannas of Africa anymore. So it's unfortunate. We've been primed for an existence that's nothing like the existence we have. Our existence means what? Means if I want to eat, I walk downstairs and open the refrigerator, and I can eat the rest of the day. And so it's a different set of challenges, and we have to respond to them in a different manner.
Absolutely. And I mean, ultimately, that is, I always get them mixed up. It's not the naturalistic fallacy, but there's another fallacy, informal fallacy, like an appeal to nature. Yes, that's the thing where like... Just because something is quote unquote natural, or just because something is how, you know, an individual evolved, does not necessarily mean it's better. And so we have to be really careful. We see it all the time, right, in scientific skepticism when we talk about the promise of genetic technology. We talk about the promise of GMOs, for example, and you see this anti-GMO movement that's like, but it's not natural. And it's like, so?
Yeah, no.
It's feeding a growing planet.
You know, natural means when somebody insults you, get really, really angry. It's really a stupid thing to do because the anger is going to hurt you much more then it hurts the other person. So yeah, I agree with you that part of the key to a successful life is to behave in an unnatural manner.
Absolutely. Yeah. Without ignoring or internalizing, or I guess I should say respecting nature, because that's another modern societal issue that that we talk about often on the show, is a total and utter lack of respect for planet Earth. But you know what? Getting back to you, a natural history, speaking of natural, getting back to this wonderful book, I would love to know, like, which perspective, because you took an angle of a lot of different perspectives. Your background was more in physics and mathematics, in addition to kind of classical philosophy. But then you approached it from a genetic perspective. You approached it from a molecular biological perspective, from all these different areas. So obviously, this must have been a learning experience for you as well. You had to do a lot of research in order to write this book. Which kind of perspective was the most, I don't know, exciting for you, or made you go like, really? That's what, whoa, look at what I learned out of this.
I learned in all of the different areas. And that's one of the things that kept it growing in me. I would just keep making all of these very interesting discoveries about the history, about what had to have happened in the past to get me where I am now. And it's absolutely surprising. Once you think about it, then it becomes, well, yeah, that's kind of how it had to happen. But the first time you hear it, it's shocking. Most people just assume, well, they're here, and that's just a fact of life, and they kind of had to be here. But you're here as a result of a remarkable set of coincidences in the past. Stars had to explode. People had to meet. You know, you go through the whole list, and your existence is a miracle. And I'm using that word miracle in a non-religious sense. But you're very lucky to exist. But that, you know, it's an interesting thing, but that's that Stoic approach coming in again, is count your blessings. You've got a lot to be thankful for.
It's an interesting way to kind of take a step back, because sometimes it is very difficult in modern society. You know, some people might argue something of an existential view, again, is kind of that, you know, many people struggle with depression in more modern times, and maybe historically just as many people struggled with depression, and we just didn't diagnose it the same way. You know, obviously these are constructs, and they're human inventions, these descriptions and labels and diagnoses, and maybe there's always been a thread of a certain percentage of a population struggling with these issues. Or maybe there is this kind of more modern view that society is quite sick, and an individualistic struggle with something like depression is to be sort of expected as a standard outcome. But regardless of that, you know, I think a common experience of somebody who is deeply depressed is to bemoan the fact that they didn't choose to be born, like that they didn't have any sort of agency in that process. And so it's such an interesting kind of alternative view that, yes, I didn't choose this. I was lucky enough to have this. And look at how insurmountable the odds were. You know, look at how stacked against my existence probability was. I'm quite a lucky one to be where I am today.
Yeah, you can take two different people, put them in the same situation. Some people will find the positive side. Some people will find the negative side. Now, the interesting thing is there are limits to what Stoicism can do. And if a person is clinically depressed, Stoicism is simply not the answer. There are a whole bunch more people, though, who have adopted a certain way of looking at the world, theory about the world and their place in it. And it's unfortunate, because that, adopting that theory, is what's putting the negative spin on the things they experience. If they could bring themselves to switch perspectives, they could turn things around in a dramatic way. I've now been a kind of a public Stoic for a decade. And in that time, I've certainly encountered people whose lives have been transformed by having these kinds of positive thoughts that Stoicism is pushing. There are other people, though, for whom it just doesn't seem to work. So I'm not a psychologist, so I can't get deep into why that should be. But there are some people who just seem really attuned to negative outlooks. Mm-hmm. And then other people for whom, you know, when I tell them what Stoicism is, they'll sort of say, well, what's so special about that? I've been doing that all my life. Okay, well, good for you. You independently discovered Stoicism. If you'd done it 2,000 years ago, we would all know your name.
And I have to say, I think there's something, you know, and again, this is kind of a more existential view coming through, but when we talk about profundity, when we really talk about, I think, what personal emotional response comes out of reading a book like yours, of understanding the long and windy road to lead to us, and kind of our very special place in the universe, regardless of whether we discover life on other worlds. You know, the odds are in the favor that they do exist, that maybe at some time, some place, there is some existence outside of ourselves. Whether or not we will ever be able to approach them or find them is a completely other conversation. But regardless of that, still, it's you know, the teeniest, tiniest chance that human beings, that Homo sapiens would have ever developed. And regardless of all of that, I personally believe that profundity, awe, you know, these different terms that we use to describe something that's almost indescribable, is almost an ambivalent emotion. It's an emotion that is both beautiful and maybe a little bit sorrowful. It's an emotion that's, you know, maybe for a Stoic like yourself, you find yourself bursting with joy thinking about those things. And for some other people, tears might come to your face and it might be a very complicated feeling. So regardless of whether you view things with a more positive or negative bent, reading a book like this is still going to bring you with a profound sense of wonder. And I think that that's really something that's uniquely human.
Yeah, the ability to see something in the world and say, wow, just simply say, mm-hmm. wow, is a wonderful ability to have. And there are people who don't seem to be surprised by much, or they don't express it. But the interesting thing about science is that the more you know about science, the more wow moments you have, because you keep going deeper, and guess what? The interesting stuff keeps turning up. So it's an interesting way, and intellectually profitable way, to enjoy the wow experience. And, you know, you talk about the emotions, the bright and the dark emotions, and whether they can be mixed. I guess, and this is certainly as I'm getting older, I've noticed there are many, many more moments than there used to be where I'll look at something and I'll think simultaneously how beautiful and how sad, mm-hmm. you know, some event, something that's happened in life is simultaneously. But I think that's part of an insight into life itself. It's this incredible mm-hmm. accident, and here we are participating in this incredible accident, and isn't that wonderful? And yet, look at how things work out. So.
Absolutely. Well, gosh, Bill, I've kept you for so long at this point, and I would be really remiss if at the end of the show I didn't ask you about my final two questions. They're kind of big picture, and who better to answer them than a professional academic philosopher? So if you're ready, I'd love to ask you the same questions I close every single episode with. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. So when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now in this moment, I would love to know first, what is the thing that really does keep you up at night? What is the thing that maybe you truly do struggle with pessimism about? You truly are, you know, deeply worried about, and maybe it's hard for you to come up with an optimistic viewpoint. But then on the flip side of that, you know, what are you really optimistic about? What do you look forward to in the future in maybe almost a childlike way, or just maybe an untinged way?
Well, first of all, just for the record, I have a profound ability to fall asleep and stay asleep, and an unfortunate tendency to wake up at 2 a.m. and then think about whatever project I'm thinking about. So I'm actually not tossing and turning over things. But there are things that I do think about, and things that worry about me, that worry me. Now, there are a whole bunch of different things, but let me raise something that lately I've been thinking about. It's kind of gone to the top of the list. And that is the impact the internet is having on, human behavior. It affects a number of things. So thanks to the internet, whatever wild beliefs you have, you can find people on the planet who agree with the beliefs you have. And that creates this psychological phenomenon known as confirmation bias. So you start going out of your way to find people who will tell you you're right in what you're thinking. And that has the unfortunate consequence of simultaneously of making you more certain that what you believe is true. And it also makes you a more closed-minded individual, because people will come up with different points of view, and you'll say, well, that person's obviously crazy because the people I know all agree with me. If you go back before the internet, it was much harder to kind of put yourself into a capsule where the only things you heard were things you wanted to hear, because you would have been exposed to a variety of other people. The news sources were not perfect, but they did give you a point of view that might have been at odds with your own. So we have a world in which people are increasingly confident that they have the answers to questions. Unfortunately, they don't. It's just that they've picked out something. And so you can see that in American politics, you know, the difference between there used to be an interesting amount of overlap between liberals and conservatives, but now you look at the chart showing the two, the curves for the two, and they're moving further and further apart. And then you look at elections, you know, you look at Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump. There are a whole bunch of people who would have said, you know, if you can find something in the middle there, I can happily vote for it. But but we had extremes represented. So I suppose that lately has been a fear that I've experienced. Now, second question.
Okay. What are you truly hopeful for in a kind of a really clean, pure way?
Okay. So this is going to tie back to the first question, because this is something else I've been thinking about. So I teach college, and the interesting thing is I've been teaching college in some sense or another for more than 40 years, if I'm doing the math right. And the college experience has changed in that time. So more and more, we college professors have formed the idea that what we're supposed to do is tell our students what to think, that we figure it out and then we tell them. Now, in some cases, that's absolutely correct. You know, if you're teaching math, you've got it figured out. There are proofs and, you know, you've got to transmit those. But in many of the liberal arts, though, you know, we have rival theories, but we also have this temptation to want to tell our students the truth. And so one of my hopes is that we will find a way to overcome that. You know, in my classes, I teach now a lot of critical thinking. And so I'm very interested in going through the entire course. At the end, I do this this survey, and students get to guess what my own political viewpoints are. And if I've succeeded, they won't know. They'll be all over the place. place. And yet, we do talk about politics. And what I tell them is, I don't care what they think. I care that they think. Mm-hmm. So my hope is that this is an approach to teaching that will spread, and I'm trying to do things that can encourage others to take this same path.
Absolutely. I love that. I mean, obviously, it's directly in line with what we often talk about here on Talk Nerdy, what we definitely talk about on my other podcast that I'm a co-host of, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. And it's just, you know, I think one of the most fundamental things that we could be striving towards right now in modern education is critical thinking skills, is you know, not what to think, but how to think. It's the whole, you know, teach a woman or a man to fish, as opposed to giving them a fish. And I think that that's, you know, so important. Anybody who listens to the show hears that reinforced on a regular basis. Bill, this was a really interesting chat. I didn't expect, obviously from the book, I expected to have an interesting chat with you, but I didn't expect to get so deep into an understanding of stoicism, into these kind of deeper philosophical views. I'm so glad that we did, though, because I'm not sure when the last time we had a conversation like this on Talk Nerdy really was. And if my listeners are anything like me, which I assume there's a little bit of crossover, it's why you guys listen to the show, I know that they found it just as deeply interesting as I did. So I have to say, first and foremost, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you so much again for having me as a guest.
Absolutely. Guys, the book is You, A Natural History by Dr. William B. Irvine. And I want to thank each of you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.